grass and the redwood forest, the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
And welcome to the People Speak Radio. This is your host, David Swanson. We are live at thepeoplespeakradio.net. We are very privileged to have with us as a guest for the next hour, Elizabeth Kucinich. And I know you are going to want to speak with her. Let me tell you right at the top how you do that. There are two ways. First, you can call in toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada at 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. From the rest of the world, toll-free 877-489-6350. That's 877-489-6350. You can also go to thepeoplespeakradio.net and go to the chat room and type in your questions, and I'll ask them for you. So whichever way you prefer. Elizabeth Kucinich has an incredibly impressive and lengthy resume that is posted at the top of thepeoplespeakradio.net, and we'll try to go through part of it in the course of the program. She holds a BA in Religious Studies and Theology and an MA in International Conflict Analysis from the University of Kent in the United Kingdom. She has all sorts of other certificates and educational background and endless resume of volunteer work and work in Africa and India and in this country. She is also, of course, the wife of Congressman Dennis Kucinich and therefore the future First Lady of this country. We are very pleased to have her on the program. Elizabeth, thanks for being on the People Speak Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be with you.
It's terrific to hear your voice. I want to ask you about some of the things I did not know about you before I read this resume. You are, of course, originally from the United Kingdom, and it says that you first lobbied the British Parliament at the age of 14. Mm-hmm. How did you get involved in that?
I was very fortunate to have a mother who was rather active. She had suffered from Crohn's disease and decided to change her diet. And through changing her diet to becoming a vegetarian, she started looking at animal welfare issues. And we joined some organizations and just started to become very politically active on the animal farming issues. So she used to take me down there, and when I found my feet, then I used to go on my own, and I would lobby members of parliament and distribute letters and do everything that a young citizen should do. So I'm very encouraged when I see young people coming to Congress in Washington doing the same thing.
Have you been a vegan since you were 14?
No, I'm afraid I dipped in and out. I'd been a vegetarian for a number of years, and then I went to Africa. Lived in Tanzania for 16 months in a village with subsistence farming community, working on community projects like rainwater harvesting and biogas plants and things like that. And I got malaria so badly, and I didn't have any real source of true nutritional food, and I fell into the pattern of eating some meat there. And when I met Dennis, immediately switched back to being vegan again. He's a very good influence.
Well, it'd be very difficult to live with Dennis and not be a vegan, I would think. Although I can attest that that you're probably the best vegan cook I've run across. Where did you learn to cook vegan dishes?
I always was the kind of person, my grandmother taught me to cook and my mother taught me to cook, and whatever was in the fridge, that's what you made dinner from. So whatever's in our fridge at home is always a vegan menu, so throw the ingredients together. I've actually been looking at maybe taking a course up in Massachusetts and then learning under Mitya Kushi some macrobiotic things. I'd love to do that. I think that food really is the way that each of us can change the world. You know, when you think about how much grain is consumed in order to produce 1 pound of ground beef, it's between, you know, 12 pounds and 36 pounds of grain to produce just 1 pound of meat. If we all decided to, you know, cut down the amount of meat that we ate, then how much food would that alleviate for others? And when we look at animal farming being the single greatest contributing factor to climate change, again, when we decide to change our diet, when we switch our dish, then we can really be benefiting the environment. And when you see again how tens of thousands of gallons of water go into producing 1 pound of beef, how we can save all of that water by changing our diet. So it's really important. This is something I think I'm going to be, well, I am working on at the moment, but certainly going to be working on much more to try and raise the awareness of our own personal choices in what we eat and how that can really affect the world.
Yeah, it's hugely important, and it seems that it's taking so long for so many people to come around. I want to go back to your teenage years, because after being a lobbyist at 14, you were teaching in Hungary at 17. What did that involve?
Oh, well, I went for a month over my summer vacation to be a teaching assistant with young people of my age. They were learning English, and I wanted to see Hungary, and it was just an incredible summer working out there and finding my feet. You might not realize it from maybe seeing me on YouTube and things, but until recently, I really couldn't say boo to a goose and was very... very embarrassed when I would publicly speak. So from an early age, I really felt that I would have more of a public role and needed to break myself into that idea. So from that time of going to Hungary, that was my way of pushing myself to the front of small audiences and trying to, you know, use teaching as a method to boost my confidence. So it kind of worked.
As an American, I think I understand what that means, that you couldn't say boo to a goose.
I know, colloquially, I'm afraid. I was shy, yeah.
Yeah. But at 18, you were offered your first job working for a member of parliament with someone who encountered you hand-delivering 600 letters on a school day to members of parliament on the issue of animal welfare and factory farming. But you chose not to take that job. So you could have been working in the equivalent of Congress over there at the age of 18.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in England, I'm not sure about America here, but in England you're allowed to go up and deliver one letter to your own member of parliament that doesn't have a stamp on it. And because the Royal Mail sorts their mail, you have to have a stamp on anything over one letter that you deliver. Well, I had 600 that I was trying to get through in one day. So it took quite a lot of doing, but I managed to do lots of lobbying and get members of parliament to deliver letters to all the people along their corridor, and was being very ingenious and occasionally fluttering my eyelashes at the person in behind the postal counter trying to get another few hundred through. And it did work, thank goodness, but that was where I met a gentleman called Tony Banks, who himself was a vegetarian and very socially conscious member of parliament. And I guess sort of the Kucinich equivalent in the UK. He's an amazing man, an animal welfare advocate, and he was the one who found me doing that and took me into his office and said, it's incredible what you're doing, and his secretary helped me put more letters through, and they offered me a job. He said I went to India.
Instead you went to India. I want to talk about what you did instead, which involved working with Mother Teresa, but we're starting to get questions coming in through the chat room, and I want to make this a public discussion to the extent that we can. And let me remind people that you can go to the chat room at thepeoplespeakradio.net and send in your questions, or you can call in toll-free and speak with Elizabeth Kucinich yourself at 888-228-4494, 888-228-4494. If you're outside the U.S. and Canada, 877-489-6350, 877-489-6350. Scott in Canada writes, given your education in peace studies, do you see a benefit to applying restorative resolution processes, healing circles, to our international relationship challenges?
Absolutely. In big capital letters, underlined, bold, with exclamation marks at each end. Definitely. Restorative justice is really the way that we have to go in so many different areas of the way that government is running and also international relations. Think along those lines, and skipping ahead a few years, you said that I took my master's degree in international conflict analysis. Indeed, I did. And my final exam in my master's degree was in conflict resolution and world politics. And that exam date was fell on September the 11th, 2001. When I walked into my exam room, you know, the world was as it was, and during the time that I was taking my exam, the events in New York were happening and the events at the Pentagon, etc. And when I walked out of the exam and I saw what had happened, and the weeks that followed thereafter, I really glued my eyes to the television. And I saw how the world was reaching out to America in a way that I'd never seen. You know, America was loved by the world anyway, but people were really reaching out. There were a million people in the streets of Iran with prayer vigil and, you know, flowers at the embassies and in France and the United Kingdom, all across Europe, the Middle East, China, you name it. Everybody reached out their hands to the United States. And what did we see and what did we hear from the administration? We just saw a really big boot kicking back up, and we started to get rhetoric. At a moment when we could have used a very, very bad series of events to reconcile the world, the administration chose to use them to cut itself off from the world. And restorative justice is what we need in so many levels. We need restorative justice with the people of Iraq, who have suffered so heavily under the burden of this illegal war and this illegal occupation. We need a process of truth and reconciliation, both inside the United States and also across the borders between the United States and other nations. A strengthening process that reaches into people's hearts through their own stories, through their own understanding of what's going on, devoid of political process. This really needs to happen, a truth and reconciliation process. And you know that Dennis has the Department of Peace legislation, and we've been talking recently about, you know, looking at changing the title of that so that it's more accessible to people, because the main ethos of the Department of Peace really is restorative justice. Maybe we should be looking at the Department of Restorative Justice and moving in those ways. So, as I say, yes, definitely big yes in answer to that gentleman's question.
I saw that that bill recently picked up its first Republican co-sponsor in Congressman Gilchrist from Maryland, who has lost an election and is on his way out, and apparently feels free to follow his conscience. But it's something that has a huge number of co-sponsors in both houses now. What is it going to take to have Congress take a step in the direction of a Department of Peace, as opposed to what it's doing now, putting up resolutions to threaten Iran, which we have yet to go to war with?
You know, we have to really understand the communication process, the fact that because, you know, somebody is elected to Congress doesn't mean that they then become somebody who bees all and knows all and is able to really understand the true in-depth dynamics. And everybody up here, I think, tries their best, but the approaches aren't necessarily the most effective, to put it kindly. And so we have to really be up there. You know, we need people from the public. We need the people to come to Congress to talk to members of Congress, which indeed, obviously, people from the Peace Alliance and the Department of Peace campaign do, and on all these different issues. It's an opportunity for our voices as the public to be heard, and people who understand that we need to take a different measure need to approach the members of Congress in a way that they can help to educate them and help them think in a different way. Because, you know, the world really is, in our own minds, is a product of the way that we think. And if we think that the world is made up of warring camps and the only way to move forward is by slating one against the other and taking sides one against the other, then that's what people do. But we need to enlighten people as to the effect that if our brothers and sisters are killing each other, it's not up to us to take sides. It's up to us to stop them from doing so and to help build relations. And there are ways to do that. There's, you know, the science of human relations, the science of peace building, heavily studied subjects around the world, especially in America. So we really need to start tapping into the expertise that are in this country. And I would ask anyone to really start getting involved. You know, write to your members, phone them, come and visit them, arrange meetings with them, speak to their aides. You know, this is an opportunity every single day up here on Capitol Hill to help people move along in the rhetoric, move along in their understanding of how to deal with situations.
And how you mentioned a truth and reconciliation commission type scenario, and I'm wondering if you've thought about what that might look like in this country in terms of the crimes of Bush and Cheney and gang of the past 7.5 years. Because I know that when they did this in South Africa, the problem was that there were too many criminals. It wasn't, you know, a handful of people on high giving orders. It was a problem of the courts not being able to handle so many criminals that they went with a different process. Whereas here, it would seem imperative to actually prosecute Bush and Cheney and certain individuals, and yet a process of education and public awareness and thoughtfulness would seem appropriate as well. What are you envisioning?
Well, we've obviously, you know, Dennis is pushing through the impeachment articles in Congress here, and steadily the debate is changing. You know, the tables, I think, are turning. It looks like impeachment is there, and the Constitution are now kind of making their way up the side of the table leg, and there is view from the people who are at the top. So that's one way. Yes, of course, we need a more of a high-level judicial process that really holds our leaders to account. But also, you know, we as the public in the United States and also the Congress have been sort of spun out of all recognition with respect to the fear factor that's continually built either through the media or when you walk through the airports where it's always, you know, orange alert, and all of those things are really led to stop people from really seeing the world, I think, in a way that they should actually be perceiving it. And it's time to really strengthen ourselves from the inside and ask questions such as, when was a time that I felt most secure? When was a time when I felt most proud of my country? When was a time when I felt happiest? All those questions that we can look at each in ourselves and answer through our own personal narrative in a group situation, so that we can really see, well, is this what's being said? Is this a true representation of what's going on, or is this really leading us to a point of being controlled? And what is my own core? What is my heart telling me? What's my gut instinct? And leading people through a process whereby they can find themselves again and find their center and find their center of it, sort of their own center of intelligence, so that they can move through all of the different spin which is being put out there at the moment. That's another kind of truth and reconciliation, a reconciliation with oneself and a reconciliation with the true values of the American spirit, when we really see the founding principles of this country, the vision of this country, part of the myth certainly, but also part of them a great deal based in reality. We need to really recreate the vision and move forward and really see where it is that we want to be in 10 years' time, 20 years' time, tomorrow, 50 years, 100 years, whatever it might be, and start moving in that direction. And the way that we can do that is by truly connecting with ourselves and with each other again.
Well, you seem to have found yourself through projects and work of a great variety all over the world, and I want to go back to what you did as a young woman. Rather than working in Parliament, you went to work at Missionaries of Charity, Mother Teresa's home in India, and later moved to a village close to the Taj Mahal, where you developed an environment-focused education project for Dalit children, providing a safe space for children of all backgrounds to socialize and learn together as equals. What can you explain that to Americans who haven't been there, and what did you gain from that work?
Well, I mean, the reason why I went in the first place was because my grandmother was born in India. She is now 85 years old, so she was born under the time of the Raj. My great-grandfather was in the army. So I used to get a lot of stories about what it was like under colonial rule and her experiences from, you know, more of an elite perspective. And then my parents always wanted to go to the Taj Mahal. They used to call it the Palace of Love. And as a true romantic myself, as you've probably seen with my beautiful husband, that was a place, the Taj Mahal, really captured my imagination. And in the 80s, when Mother Teresa used to be shown on BBC, serving and administering to the poor, I felt all of these different elements come together. And I knew that as soon as I could leave, you know, the school system and find my fledgling wings, I would buy a ticket and go to India, and that's indeed what I did. I hadn't got any plans as to where I was going to go, but I did have a vision of what it was that I wanted to do. And I decided to head straight to Agra, where the Taj Mahal is, and found that there was a Missionaries of Charity home there, and I knocked on the door one day and spoke to a lovely nun called Sister Rosa, and offered my services, and she took me in, and every day I worked there for 3 months with these beautiful children, and also there was quite a large adult wing as well of adults who had different learning and physical disabilities. And so I was there for some time and really learned on the ground what it was like and just learned about myself too, being able to love every single day, being able to be a mother to a number of, you know, dozens of children every single day and not have the responsibility of having to feed them, but having the responsibility of having to, you know, really make sure that they had all of their emotional needs catered for was an incredible experience for me as an 18-year-old. And shortly after being there, I traveled around a bit and I met somebody who wanted to set up an education project, indeed, for the children of the Untouchables, which is a caste that's below the caste system in India. It's the caste that really has the most terrible jobs and has the fewest opportunities. And I moved to a village, and that's indeed what I did for another few months. Helped create an environment whereby these young people could come together in the mornings prior to the work that they had to do. So their lessons were starting about 6 o'clock in the morning and going on till around 8. And after that, they would go off and do the work that they would have to do to support their families. But it was an incredible time when I really was able to use some of the skills that I'd learned with my teaching qualifications and with my time in Hungary as well to help people to really open their eyes to the beauty of the environment that's around them. And I knew I wasn't going to be able to get these children through to high school or through to university or anything, but something that I could do was help them to see their environment in a way and to see the magic of the natural world around them. And I think that to some degree, me and the small team that I put together really managed to do that. And a couple of afternoons a week, all the children of the village would come together, and it was incredible because there was this full redhead jumping on the flat roof, up and down on the flat roof of a house, doing Simon Says and all different educational game sessions with these children, and all the village would look on up at the roof. It was a very funny time, but it was incredible for me, and I think that the children really benefited from it too.
It sounds terrific. You've mentioned that you lived in East Africa. You've lived in India. You've lived in parts of the world that are much poorer than ours, which gives a perspective on what the major problems and solutions might be to the world's crises. And something struck me in your resume that I can't begin to ask you about because I don't know the subject, but it surprised me. And it says that you've worked with the Forum of Stable Currencies at the House of Lords, London, and organized the American Monetary Institute's first international conference in Chicago. And for you, reforming the global debt-based money system is the most pressing issue of our time. Is that still true, and what would that involve?
Well, you know, so many people look at the area of poverty and, you know, say we've got to solve all these problems of poverty, and then they look at climate change and look at the environment, we've got to solve all these issues. And what I saw when I first was introduced to the idea of monetary reform, and I'll come into what it is just, you know, a little bit later on, but what I saw was all of these things are effects of something that's going on. Now, what is that something that's going on? And much of it really is the economic system. And I don't want to blind people with words or concepts or anything, but the basis of this idea is that, you know, money is something which is exchanged. It's the thing that connects goods and services with people and resources. So money is the sort of lubricating factor that keeps that relationship flowing between, you know, whether there are jobs because of resources or jobs and needs. There are always people who need work. There are always jobs that need to be done, but there's not always the money there to service those needs. And when you look at money, people think, oh, well, you know, there's just money in a system and it just kind of magics its way in there. But that's not what happens. Our monetary system is debt-based, which means that the more money we have in the system has to come from us borrowing that money from somewhere. And the place that we borrow that money from are the private financial institutions, the central banks, effectively, or the banks, the private banks that are under the central banks. And we're seeing that a debt-based monetary system, which literally borrowing money into circulation, is what's causing us to have to keep on year in year destroying more and more natural resources in order to keep up debt payments, to destroy more and more services to the people in order to keep up debt payments. You see, businesses are in debt, people are in debt, nations are in debt. Well, who are they in debt to? They're in debt to a system which has a fundamental flaw. In my opinion, money should be something which is, you know, created as a plus, as a positive on a scale, as opposed to as being a debt. It can obviously be borrowed in the case of I don't have enough money to buy a house, therefore I have to borrow from a bank. That's fine. But in order to get money into the system in the first place, it should be created as a neutral value. And we have to see that the private financial institutions have been given the right and privilege to create money out of nothing and charge the rest of the world for the privilege of using that money. And that system has to change.
On that major note to be worked on in the coming decades, we have to take a few minute break for important messages. I know we have at least a caller or two waiting that we will get to as soon as we get back from the break. If you want to call in and join the conversation, it's 888-228-4494. That's toll free in the U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494. Elsewhere in the world, 877-489-6350. This is your host, David Swanson. You can go to thepeoplespeakradio.net and send in your questions for Elizabeth Kucinich, who will be with us until the end of the hour. We will be back in just a few minutes.
More than 1 million children are forced into prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. The economic difficulties contribute to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime, to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit SOSMorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
Got questions? The library has got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
This is Gore Vidal. Can you name the one country on earth where the government can steal elections, strip away basic rights, spy on civilians, launch wars based on lies, and where the people do not take over the nation's capital in protest? If you said the United States, you'd be right. So let's remedy that by calling our Congress members and asking them to support the impeachment of George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by After Downing Street.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city wall, by the relief of death, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest.
According to polls, a majority of Americans support the impeachment of Dick Cheney. To make people aware of this, the Honk to Impeach campaign has been organized. People will be carrying Honk to Impeach signs in front of congressional district offices and TV and radio stations. Visit ImpeachSpace.com and ImpeachCheney.org for updates of this effort. And don't forget to honk for impeachment.
And we are back at the People Speak Radio, live at thepeoplespeakradio.net, where you can send in your questions through the chat room. You can call in to speak with our guest, Elizabeth Kucinich, toll-free at 888-228-4494. If you are outside the U.S. and Canada, 877-489-6350. And we were speaking, Elizabeth, before the break about monetary reform. And you mentioned that there's a video you wanted to recommend. Could you tell people what that is?
Yes, I know that I've just really rambled for the last few minutes on an issue which is new to very many people. And there's just a fantastic video which is on Google Video if you search money as debt. And it's a 47-minute cartoon. I say 47 minutes, it's under an hour, so you got time to watch it. And I didn't have anything to do with putting it together, but to me it's the best introduction to this issue, and it really covers sustainability, the environment, poverty, all of those things, but from a perspective that very many people have not really had the opportunity to be made aware of yet. And so if everybody could go to Google Video and watch Money as Debt, I think you would really benefit a great deal from that. And you can help me with a new movement.
We will post a link at thepeoplespeakradio.net, and otherwise search for Money as Debt at Google Video. And I was asking you during the break what you think pros and cons of Ron Paul's Republican presidential candidacy's focus on monetary reform.
He has the right idea when it comes to understanding that we've been done a great injustice with the private financial institutions, the private central banking systems being in control of the money system when it really should be the people's part of the government, really. I mean, it's the people's power as opposed to private institutions' power. But he goes into the gold standard and going back to really gold-based financial systems, and any commodity-based currency systems can be manipulated. Those people who own the gold will be the people who own and control the financial system. We really need a new kind of financial system which takes the best practice from financial systems from over the centuries. You know, look at the really big civilizations. How was it that they managed to grow and develop and become prosperous and successful? The gentleman that I worked with, Stephen Zarlenga, at the American Monetary Institute, researched and researched and researched for very, very many years and put together a fabulous book called The Lost Science of Money. And you can find that at monetary.org. It's The Lost Science of Money. It's a brick of a book, I like to call it, because it's very, very deep and very thick, very heavy. But it goes into all of these issues and really will outline why we need to go in the direction that we need to go in and why commodity-based monies are not necessarily the most healthy alternative to what we've got at the moment.
We have a caller who's been waiting on the line for quite a while, Roger from Augusta, Maine. Did you have a question for Elizabeth Kucinich?
Well, I just wanted to let Elizabeth know that John McCain, or as we call him, John McSain, will be visiting Kennebunkport on July 21st.
Mm-hmm.
And just as before, Mainers are gathering, and we will have a march on the morning of July 21st at 10 o'clock. And I wanted to thank Elizabeth and her husband Dennis for attending the previous march and rally that we had in Kennebunkport.
It was a wonderful event, and thank you so much, Dennis, and I so enjoyed being with everyone there. It was such a fabulous, fabulous spirit in Maine when we went up there the last time. I will never forget it, and the reason I'll never forget it is because Dennis and I were marching towards the front of the parade with a banner, and the closer we got to a certain person's house, the more opposition we were feeling from crowds that were gathering around who had signs such as support the troops, keep them there, you know, keep them dying in a war that is based on lies, and a certain line of logic that I don't quite understand, but they were becoming more and more hostile. And after a little while, there was a group of these sort of more militant people from the other opinion side who came in and marched in front of us. And there were all of these veterans for peace who were behind us, these young men who'd just come back from serving in Iraq, who knew exactly what it felt like. And they just very gently and very quietly, they jogged round, they were wearing their combats, they jogged round in front of the march that we were leading, and they jogged further and further and kind of pushed these other people more and more to the margins, very, very gently. But it was one of the most beautiful maneuvers that I'd seen, and from that moment, you know, I've always been very supportive of veterans, but when I saw the way that they dealt with that situation in such a non-violent and incredibly useful gesture, it was an amazing experience. So good luck, and thank you to everybody who's going to be on that march on the 21st.
Thanks, Roger, for calling in. I've been to one of those Kennebunkport marches, and it's a terrific town and a terrific state. We are getting a bunch of questions through our chat room, Elizabeth, about monetary issues now. I hope you don't mind if we take one or two of them.
As long as everyone else doesn't mind. No.
I hope not. Russ from Nebraska asks, Mrs. Kucinich, do you see opportunity to build grassroots barter systems to reduce the negative impacts of the flat monetary system on impoverished peoples?
Absolutely. There is obviously room for alternative currencies, complementary currencies, etc. But what I've really tried to do myself is focus on reforming the monopoly currency system, which we all suffer the burden of. Because if we divert our energies away from what the real issue is, then we'll never be addressing the real issue. So there is room for, you know, there are room for barter systems, there are room for complementary currencies, but we have to focus our main attention on, you know, really challenging this system, which is completely unjust and really is what is destroying the equity value of, you know, everything in this country and around the world. Something that I have been working on, however, which is, you know, somewhat in answer to your question, is working with an organization or a model called Worth. And Worth is a model of microfinance, only it's not a debt-based microfinance where people are lending small amounts of money to people in, you know, the global south. This is an equity-based model, which it's just so much more effective, whereby we educate people to really pool their money, to save their money, and to lend them their money to each other, thereby taking on the role almost as a community bank and having all the benefits that a bank would normally be taking away, such as interest payments and an equity base, and giving it to communities, having, you know, 20 or 25 people coming together every week, saving together, having a savings pool, lending to each other at a certain rate of interest, that interest being paid back into the savings pool, so the equity grows, they have use of the money, they help to create each other's business, they help to community build. It's a fantastic model that's now in 8 different countries, including Nepal and Uganda. I was out in Uganda last year working with a group there on it. And what I'm working to do is bring it back to the United States. And one of the pilots that I'm setting up, I actually started to set it up last week, the first one will be in Cleveland. We're also working now to set up a pilot in Mexico. We've not done anything down in Latin America. And we really feel that we need to start creating models where people can help themselves. So there are so many different options out there, but if anyone's interested in that, that's called Worth.
You may have just been describing something that's a step above what this next question is about, but let me ask it anyway. Mike in California asks, I'm glad you addressed the issue of economics. Are you acquainted with Nobel Peace Laureate Dr. Muhammad Yunus, whose microeconomics eradicated poverty in Bangladesh?
I am indeed aware of his work, and I admire him for really, you know, showing what amazing people, you know, people who don't have are obviously as trustworthy as those who have access to credit already. Something that I've seen with the Yunus model is that it's great because what it really does is it gives people financial opportunities. It gives people access to credit, such as those that, you know, we have credit cards and things and they have access to microfinance models. But it's still a credit-based system. It's still encouraging people to get into debt in order to get out of poverty, which to me is, it's a step, but it's not the answer. If it was the answer, then, you know, we in America would all be prosperous and full of equality, and we're obviously not there at all. So I would really like to, you know, push the Yunus model and move it more into something that can be developed for, which is obviously what we're doing, an equity-based, a savings-based, so we can build a culture more on savings and growing equity within communities. What we find, obviously, with when you're just lending small amounts of money into communities at interest, very, very many microfinance models lend money to these poor communities, which helps them to a degree, but then they also charge usurious rates of interest, sometimes upwards of 30% per month. And that is actually, you know, destroying very many communities. So we're seeing the effects now of some of these models that are starting to go out of control. So we need to really, you know, look at what's working and see the role for one type of model and also have room to put in other areas as well, different models that can really help people to build equity into their communities.
Well, let me change the subject slightly because we've got some questions on this topic, and this may be the impossible riddle of the universe. But Jana, also from California, asks, why isn't Bush being impeached?
Well, it's a question that we often ask ourselves every single day for the last, I don't know how many years. I don't know. I really
not,
don't.
Not for lack of Congressman Kucinich trying, anyway.
Not for lack of good people trying. I can't imagine to be able to step into people's hearts, into their shoes, into their minds. All I can say is that we really as a nation need to start to step into our integrity and have the courage to really not just talk amongst ourselves, but have our voices expressed loud and clear, and really make our presence felt in a very constructive way. When we look at what happened in, I think it was Korea, was it Korea who had the recent turmoil over the trade agreements passed with the United States with beef and things, David, yeah? When you saw the pictures there, just on a dime, they passed this legislation, they passed these new trading practices, the people were not happy, and millions of people took to the streets, and they kept taking to the streets until the cabinet resigned and different things had to take place. And we don't see that. You know, I'm on Capitol Hill, and there's a wonderful man who sits up here on a corner with a sign around his neck. He goes on fasts a lot and, you know, sort of starves himself to try and bring raise awareness to the issue of Iraq, and shows these pictures of these poor children who've been born with the effects of depleted uranium, and children who have obviously been hurt by bombs and severely, you know, injured. But that's one man. And then we have, you know, the people who are the Code Pink who come up here. There's a few dedicated ladies who are up here But other than that, the presence is not felt on the Hill. You know, you would you know when people are chattering about it in their living rooms and maybe in their town halls, but we don't feel it in Washington yet. We really need to feel it. People, we really need to know that the people really are rallying around the Constitution, rallying around the truth, and give these people the courage to truly move in the right direction. We heard Nancy Pelosi last week say that they would be hopefully having, you know, impeachment hearings. Well, we found out this week that indeed Dennis will be presenting next Friday, the 25th. He will be presenting to the Judiciary Committee on the article that he read into the record this week, which, or was it last week, the one on Bush leading America into a war based on lies, all about Iraq. Dennis will be presenting that to the Judiciary Committee with all of the evidence, so we can say that things are moving ahead, and they're moving ahead much quicker than some of us may have anticipated, thank goodness. So let's keep applying the pressure. There is a petition that you can sign, which is on the website, Kucinich.us. I hope that you all know how to spell Dennis's last name, but it's Kucinich.us. This is what we're calling the official petition, because all of the signatures that go on to this petition will be hand-delivered to Congress by Dennis. And we really need for the country to show the support for truth and the support for the Constitution. So please go online, sign up, and get your friends and all the people on your contact list to sign up to this petition, because he will be delivering that to the Speaker. He will be delivering that to all different members of Congress who are, the key decision makers. So it's all, the power is in the people's hands.
Well, and it's very useful, I think, what you just told people, Elizabeth, about the lack of presence of the public and the public will on Capitol Hill. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it wouldn't be a bad idea if people chose to take an early weekend and go to Washington, D.C. on the 25th of this month, on that Friday, and be there for this hearing into possible grounds for impeachment.
I think that would be amazing, and I also think that when people do that, we have to be very constructive. We've got to know what it is that we're supporting. As activists, we need to be creating the opportunities that we want to see moving into the future. We want to focus on the true positive elements, like standing up for the Constitution, standing up for the truth, as opposed to being at loggerheads and being against people. We need to be supporting what it is that we want. And when we have that quality in our hearts, I think that we will see things really moving forward quickly. So, yes, absolutely. Come to Washington, not only on the 25th, but on the weeks, the days that are preceding that, and also the days that continue afterwards. You know, we really need to see you up here. We really need to feel your presence. We need you to be constructive. We need you to lobby. So many times we hear, well, the corporate lobbyists are so powerful. You know, corporations are organized. They come up here, they talk to members of Congress, they put their points of view across, and we need people to come up here and do the same in the same constructive way and show engagement with the political system and start to really be an active citizenry again.
Well, we know some people have a hard time getting off work to do that, but some people can do it and should.
They can make phone calls, send letters, go to your local district office. You know, your member of Congress should be there at least a day a week, and if not the member of Congress, then some of their maybe the district director or some of their legislative aides, go there, show your presence, make a phone call. You elect these people, they're there to represent you, and that's your right as a citizen to really, you know, do whatever you can, whatever your time limits are. I'm sure you have the opportunity to do something. And if it is even just sign a petition at Kucinich.us, just takes a few minutes, it will make a difference.
We are sadly almost out of time. Let's see if we can get one more phone call in. Steve from Santa Fe, do you have a question for Elizabeth Kucinich?
Yes, Ms. Kucinich, thank you. And it's refreshing to hear somebody that's got such a close handle on things. My question, and I'll be concise because of the lack of time, I'm looking at a Democratic Party that's let me down. I voted for your husband every time he's ran. And
thank
we
you.
Need somebody like your husband as a president. But, of course, the media doesn't give him time, neither does the system. Do you think, I should say, there is rhetoric out there that says we should give up the parties, the Democratic and Republican Party, and turn to a third party. What's your idea on that? And I'll listen online. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your question. You know, we at the moment we're really in a, we're stuck between a rock and a hard place. You know, we've got an election that's there, and we really need to make sure, we as the people really need to make sure that we're going to be represented. And it's very important that, you know, we vote. It's very important that we engage with this political system and keep moving the debate forward. A couple of weeks ago, who would have thought that Dennis would be going to present material to the Judiciary Committee? But hard work and diligence and the support of people in the public sphere, and, you know, the building of this rhetoric has really pushed this agenda forward much quicker than, you know, maybe some in the mainstream media would have anticipated. It's up to all of us to really make sure that we move things forward. If people don't hear about Dennis in the mainstream media, we have to remember we are all mediums ourselves, and I don't necessarily mean the spiritual kinds. I mean, we are all communicators of information. So many of us now, never before has there been a time when so many of us can have our points of view put across. So many people have MySpace pages and parts of different social networking sites and blogs and vlogs and goodness knows what. At the flick of a button, we can be reaching many, many hundreds of thousands of people. So we as the people actually now do have a voice, and it's our opportunity to really push that forward. You know, we can always complain about what mainstream media are doing or aren't doing, but we have to focus on what we ourselves are or aren't doing. We are the agents of change. We as individuals really can make a very big difference. People around us listen to us. Our family listen to you. You know, your family listen to you. Your friends will listen to you. So keep going. Keep spreading the word. Keep pushing. And in time, who knows? You know, we have to have an allegiance to the Constitution. We have to have an allegiance to the country, and we should have an allegiance to the greater humanity at large. And when we really focus on those big issues, we can use political parties as vehicles, but they're not the be-all and end-all. They can help and they can hinder, and we can use them in their place. And we need to push these agenda forward all the way through. So that's what Dennis and I really try to do, stay above the fray and keep our minds focused on the vision that we're trying to create, and just keep making those small changes happen, because those tiny ripples of hope really will start to move things in ways that, well, you know, we just can only dream of at the moment.
Extremely well said. We are over our allotted time. Elizabeth Kucinich, thank you so very much for being on the People Speak Radio.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you.
Thank you, and we will be posting more information and links to things we've discussed at thepeoplespeakradio.net. Watch for upcoming programs there, and we depend on your financial support to keep this radio show online and on the air. Go to thepeoplespeakradio.net and make a contribution when you can. This is your host, David Swanson. Speak with you very soon.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the seawall, by the relief of the fast, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.